only to find that, my goodness, there aren't as many people in the pews today. Where in the world has everybody gone? Chapter 14. The Meal. Grass-fed. Before I left the farm Friday, I gathered together the makings for that evening's dinner, which I'd arranged to cook for some old friends who lived in Charlottesville. I had originally thought about filling a cooler with polyface meat and bringing it home with me to California to cook there, but decided it would be more in keeping with the whole local food chain concept to eat this particular meal within a leisurely drive of the farm where it had been grown. After all, it was the sin of flying meat across the country that had brought me to Swope in the first place, and I hated for Joel to think that an entire week of his instruction had left me unimproved. From the walk-in, I picked out two of the chickens we had slaughtered on Wednesday and a dozen of the eggs I'd helped gather Thursday evening. I also stopped by the hoop house and harvested a dozen ears of sweet corn. In consideration of my week's labors, Joel refused to accept payment for the food. But had I paid for it, the chicken would have cost $2.05 a pound, and the eggs $2.20 a dozen. Prices that compare very favorably with Whole Foods's. This is not boutique food. On the way into Charlottesville, I stopped to pick up a few other ingredients, trying as best as I could to look for local produce and preserve the barcode virginity of this meal. For my salad, I found some nice-looking locally grown rocket. At the wine shop, I found a short, chauvinistic shelf of Virginia wines, but here I hesitated. How far could I take this local conceit before it ruined my meal? I hadn't had a sip of wine all week and was really looking forward to a decent one. I'd read somewhere that winemaking in Virginia was coming into its own, but isn't that what they always say? Then I spotted a Viognier for $25. The priciest Virginia wine I'd ever seen. I took this as a sign of genuine confidence on somebody's part and added the bottle to my cart. I also needed some chocolate for the dessert I had in mind. Fortunately, the state of Virginia produces no chocolate to speak of, so I was free to go for the good Belgian stuff, panglessly. In fact, even the most fervent eat local types say it's okay for a food shed. A term for a regional food chain, meant to liken it to a watershed, to trade for goods it can't produce locally. Coffee, tea, sugar, chocolate. A practice that predates the globalization of our food chain by a few thousand years. Phew. During the week, I'd given some thought to what I should make. The farm's varied offerings certainly gave me plenty of choices. Working backward, I knew I wanted to make a dessert that would prominently feature polyface eggs, having heard so much from the chefs about their magical properties. A chocolate souffle, since it calls for a certain degree of magic, seemed the obvious choice. For a side dish, sweet corn was a no-brainer. There'd be kids at the table, and no one had tasted corn yet this summer. But what meat to serve? Because it was only June, Polyface had no fresh beef or pork or turkey. Joel wouldn't begin slaughtering beeves and turkeys till later in the summer, hogs not till the fall. There was frozen beef and pork in the walk-in, last season's, but I preferred to make something fresh. Rabbit seemed risky. I had no idea whether Mark and Liz liked it, and the chances that their boys would eat bunny were slim. So that had left chicken, the animal with which I'd been most intimate this week, which, truth to tell, left me feeling vaguely queasy. Was I going to be able to enjoy eating chicken so soon after my stint in the processing shed and gut composting pile? That queasiness perhaps explains the multi-step preparation I finally settled on. When I got to Mark and Liz's house, there were still several hours before dinner, which meant there was enough time for me to brine the chicken. So I cut each of the two birds into 8 pieces and immersed them in a bath consisting of water, kosher salt, sugar, a bay leaf, a splash of soy sauce, a garlic clove, and a small handful of peppercorns and coriander seeds. My plan was to slow roast the chicken pieces on a wood fire, and brining, which causes meat to absorb moisture and breaks down the proteins that can toughen it on a grill, would keep the chicken from drying out. But the brining, like the carving of the birds into pieces, promised to do something else too, something for me as much as the meat. It would put a little distance between the meal and Wednesday's kill, certain aromas of which were still lodged in my nostrils. One of the reasons we cook meat, besides making it tastier and easier to digest, is to civilize or sublimate what is at bottom a fairly brutal transaction between animals. The anthropologist Claude Lévi-Strauss described the work of civilization as the process of transforming the raw into the cooked, nature into culture. For these particular chickens, which I had personally helped to kill and eviscerate, the brining would make a start on that transformation even before the cooking fire was lit. Both literally and metaphorically, a saltwater bath cleanses meat, which perhaps explains why the kosher laws, one culture's way of coming to terms with the killing and eating of animals, insist on the salting of meat. After a few hours, I removed and rinsed the chicken pieces, and then spread them out to dry for an hour or two, so that the skin, now slightly waterlogged, would brown nicely. Since Mark and Liz had a gas barbecue, I'd have to simulate my wood fire. So I snipped a couple of twigs off their apple tree, stripped the leaves, and placed the twigs on top of the grill, where the green wood would smolder rather than burn. I turned the gas down low and, after rubbing a little olive oil on the chicken pieces, arranged them on the grill among the apple branches, leaving some room to add the corn later. While the chicken roasted slowly outside, I got to work in the kitchen preparing the souffle with Willie, Mark and Liz's 12-year-old. While Willie melted the chocolate in a saucepan, I separated the eggs. The yolks were a gorgeous, carroty shade of orange, and they did seem to possess an unusual integrity. Separating them from the whites was a cinch. After adding a pinch of salt, I began beating the egg whites. Within minutes, they turned from translucent to bright white and formed soft, rounded peaks, which is when Julia Child says to begin adding sugar, and to turn the beater on high. Now the egg whites rapidly doubled in volume, then doubled again, as billions of microscopic air pockets formed amid the stiffening egg proteins. When the heat of the oven caused these air pockets to expand, the soufflé would rise, assuming everything went according to plan. Once the egg whites formed a stiff, spiky snowscape, I stopped. Willie had already blended the yolks into his melted chocolate, so we now gently folded that thick syrup into my egg whites, then poured the airy, toast-colored mixture into a souffle dish and put it aside. I could see why pastry chefs in Charlottesville swore by polyface eggs. What Joel had called their muscle tone made baking with them a breeze. Willie and I brought the corn out on the deck to shuck. The ears were so fresh that the husks squealed as you peeled them back. I mentioned to Willie that our entire meal would be a celebration of the chicken. Not only the eponymous entree, which we could smell sweetly roasting on the grill, but the souffle with its half-dozen eggs, and even this corn, which I explained had grown in a deep bed of composted chicken manure. Probably not the sort of detail you'd want to mention on a menu, but Willie agreed there was something pretty neat about the alchemy involved, how a plant could transform chicken crap into something as sweet and tasty and golden as an ear of corn. Golden Bantam. The corn in question is an heirloom variety introduced in 1902, long before the hybridizers figured out how to amp up the sweetness in sweet corn. This momentous change in the genetics of our corn is an artifact of an industrial food chain, which demands that vegetables be able to endure a cross-country road trip after picking so that they might be available everywhere the year round. This was a particular problem for corn, the sugars of which begin turning to starch the moment it is picked. So in the early 60s, the breeders figured out a way to breed in extra copies of the genes responsible for producing sugars. But something was lost in the translation from local to cosmopolitan corn. The kernels lost much of their creaminess, and the specific taste of corn was overwhelmed by a generic, one-dimensional sweetness. The needs of a long industrial food chain might justify such a trade-off, but when you can eat corn picked a few hours before dinner, there's no reason for it. Unless, of course, an industrial diet of easy sugars has dulled your taste for the earthy sweetness of corn, now that it has to compete with things like soda. I had made pretty much the same meal on several occasions at home, using the same basic foodstuffs. Yet, in certain invisible ways, this wasn't the same food at all. Apart from the high color of the egg yolks, these eggs looked pretty much like any other eggs. The chicken like chicken. But the fact that the animals in question had spent their lives outdoors on pastures rather than in a shed eating grain distinguished their flesh and eggs in important, measurable ways. A growing body of scientific research indicates that pasture substantially changes the nutritional profile of chicken and eggs, as well as of beef and milk. The question we asked about organic food, is it any better than the conventional kind, turns out to be much easier to answer in the case of grass-farmed food. Perhaps not surprisingly, the large quantities of beta-carotene, vitamin E, and folic acid present in green grass find their way into the flesh of the animals that eat that grass. It's the carotenoids that give these egg yolks their carroty color. That flesh will also have considerably less fat in it than the flesh of animals fed exclusively on grain. Also, no surprise, in light of what we know about diets high in carbohydrates. And about exercise, something pastured animals actually get. But all fats are not created equal. Polyunsaturated fats are better for us than saturated ones, and certain unsaturated fats are better than others. As it turns out, the fats created in the flesh of grass eaters are the best kind for us to eat. This is no accident. Taking the long view of human nutrition, we evolved to eat the sort of foods available to hunter-gatherers, most of whose genes we've inherited and whose bodies we still, more or less, inhabit. Humans have had less than 10,000 years, an evolutionary blink, to accustom our bodies to agricultural food, and as far as our bodies are concerned, industrial agricultural food. A diet based largely on a small handful of staple grains, like corn, is still a biological novelty. Animals raised outdoors on grass have a diet much more like that of the wild animals humans have been eating at least since the Paleolithic era than that of the grain-fed animals we only recently began to eat. So it makes evolutionary sense that pastured meats, the nutritional profile of which closely resembles that of wild game, would be better for us. Grass-fed meat, milk, and eggs contain less total fat and less saturated fats than the same foods from grain-fed animals. Pastured animals also contain conjugated linoleic acid, CLA, a fatty acid that some recent studies indicate may help reduce weight and prevent cancer, and which is absent from feedlot animals. But perhaps most important, meat, eggs, and milk from pastured animals also contain higher levels of omega-3s, essential fatty acids created in the cells of green plants and algae that play an indispensable role in human health, and especially in the growth and health of neurons, brain cells. It's important to note that fish contain higher levels of the most valuable omega-3s than land animals. Yet grass-fed animals do offer significant amounts of such important omega-3s as alpha-linoleic acid, ALA. Much research into the role of omega-3s in the human diet remains to be done, but the preliminary findings are suggestive. Researchers report that pregnant women who receive supplements of omega-3s give birth to babies with higher IQs. Children with diets low in omega-3s exhibit more behavioral and learning problems at school. And puppies eating diets high in omega-3s prove easier to train. All these claims come from papers presented at a 2004 meeting of the International Society for the Study of Fatty Acids and Lipids. One of the most important yet unnoticed changes to the human diet in modern times has been in the ratio between omega-3 and omega-6, the other essential fatty acid in our food. Omega-6 is produced in the seeds of plants. Omega-3 in the leaves. As the name indicates, both kinds of fat are essential, but problems arise when they fall out of balance. In fact, there's research to suggest that the ratio of these fats in our diet may be more important than the amounts. Too high a ratio of omega-6 to 3 can contribute to heart disease, probably because omega-6 helps blood clot, while omega-3 helps it flow. Omega-6 is an inflammatory. Omega-3, an anti-inflammatory. As our diet, and the diet of the animals we eat, shifted from one based on green plants to one based on grain, from grass to corn, the ratio of omega-6 to omega-3 has gone from roughly 1 to 1 in the diet of hunter-gatherers to more than 10 to 1. The process of hydrogenating oil also eliminates omega-3s. We may one day come to regard this shift as one of the most deleterious dietary changes wrought by the industrialization of our food chain. It was a change we never noticed, since the importance of omega-3s was not recognized until the 1970s. As in the case of our imperfect knowledge of soil, the limits of our knowledge of nutrition have obscured what the industrialization of the food chain is doing to our health. But changes in the composition of fats in our diet may account for many of the diseases of civilization, cardiac, diabetes, obesity, etc., that have long been linked to modern eating habits, as well as for learning and behavioral problems in children and depression in adults. Research in this area promises to turn a lot of conventional nutritional thinking on its head. It suggests, for example, that the problem with eating red meat, long associated with cardiovascular disease, may owe less to the animal in question than to that animal's diet. This might explain why there are hunter-gatherer populations today who eat far more red meat than we do without suffering the cardiovascular consequences. These days, farmed salmon are being fed like feedlot cattle on grain, with the predictable result that their omega-3 levels fall well below those of wild fish. Wild fish have especially high levels of omega-3 because the fat concentrates as it moves up the food chain from the algae and phytoplankton that create it. Conventional nutritional wisdom holds that salmon is automatically better for us than beef, but that judgment assumes the beef has been grain-fed and the salmon krill-fed. If the steer is fattened on grass and the salmon on grain, we might actually be better off eating the beef. Grass-finished beef has a 2-to-1 ratio of omega-6 to 3 compared to more than 10-to-1 in corn-fed beef. The species of animal you eat may matter less than what the animal you're eating has itself eaten. The fact that the nutritional quality of a given food, and of that food's food, can vary not just in degree but in kind throws a big wrench into an industrial food chain, the very premise of which is that beef is beef and salmon salmon. It also throws a new light on the whole question of cost, for if quality matters so much more than quantity, then the price of a food may bear little relation to the value of the nutrients in it. If units of omega-3s and beta-carotene and vitamin E are what an egg shopper is really after, then Joel's $2.20 a dozen pastured eggs actually represents a much better deal than the 79 cents a dozen industrial eggs at the supermarket. As long as one egg looks pretty much like another, all the chickens like chicken and beef beef, the substitution of quantity for quality will go on unnoticed by most consumers. But it is becoming increasingly apparent to anyone with an electron microscope or a mass spectrometer that, truly, this is not the same food. Okay, but what about to someone equipped with a more or less standard-issue set of human taste buds? How different does a pastured chicken actually taste? It certainly smelled wonderful when I raised the lid on the barbecue to put the corn on. The chicken was browning nicely, the skin beginning to crisp and take on the toasty tones of oiled wood. The corn, on which I'd rubbed some olive oil and sprinkled salt and pepper, would take only a few minutes. All it needed was to heat up and for a scattering of kernels to brown. The browning of the chicken skin and the corn looked similar, but in fact it owed to completely different chemical reactions, reactions that were contributing to their flavors and smells. The corn was caramelizing as its sugars broke apart under the heat and formed into hundreds of more complicated aromatic compounds, giving a smoky dimension to the corny sweetness. Meanwhile, the chicken skin was undergoing what chemists called the Maillard reaction, in which carbohydrates in the chicken react in dry heat with certain amino acids to create an even larger and more complicated set of compounds that, because they include atoms of sulfur and nitrogen, give a richer, meatier aroma and taste to the meat than it would otherwise possess. This, at least, is how a chemist would explain what I was seeing and smelling on the grill as I turned the corn and chicken pieces and felt myself growing hungrier. While the corn finished roasting, I removed the chicken from the grill and set it aside to rest. A few minutes later, I called everyone to the table. Ordinarily, I might have felt a little funny serving as both dinner host and guest, but Mark and Liz are such close friends it seemed perfectly natural to be cooking for them in their home. That's not to say I didn't feel the cook's customary preprandial apprehension, compounded in this instance by the fact that Liz herself is such a good cook and holds very definite opinions about food. I certainly hadn't forgotten the time she'd wrinkled her nose and pushed away a polyfaced steak I'd served her. Grass-fed beef is flavored by the pastures it grows on, usually but not always for the best. It had tasted fine to me. I passed the platters of chicken and corn and proposed a toast. I offered thanks first to my hosts come guests, then to Joel Salatin and his family for growing the food before us and for giving it to us, and then finally to the chickens, who in one way or another had provided just about everything we were about to eat. My secular version of grace, I suppose, acknowledging the various material and karmic debts incurred by this meal, debts which I felt more keenly than usual. At the beginning of the meal, Briat Savarin writes in his chapter On the Pleasures of the Table in the Physiology of Taste, each guest eats steadily, without speaking or paying attention to anything which may be said. And so we did, aside from a few sublingual murmurs of satisfaction. I don't mind saying the chicken was out of this world. The skin had turned the color of mahogany and the texture of parchment, almost like a Peking duck, and the meat itself was moist, dense, and almost shockingly flavorful. I could taste the brine and applewood, of course, but also the chicken itself, which more than held its own against those strong flavors. This may not sound like much of a compliment, but to me the chicken smelled and tasted exactly like chicken. Liz voiced her approval in similar terms, pronouncing it a more chickeny chicken. Which is to say, I suppose, that it chimed with that capitalized idea of chicken we hold in our heads, but seldom taste anymore. So what accounted for it? The grass? The grubs? The exercise? I know what Joel would have said. When chickens get to live like chickens, they'll taste like chickens too. The flavors of everything else on the table had a similarly declarative quality. The roasted corn and lemony rocket salad, and even the peachy viennois, all of them tasting almost flamboyantly themselves, their flavors forming a bright sequence of primary colors. There was nothing terribly subtle about this meal, but everything about it tasted completely in character. Everyone was curious to hear about the farm, especially after tasting the food that had come off it. Matthew, who's 15 and currently a vegetarian, he confined himself to the corn, had many more questions about killing chickens than I thought it wise to answer at the dinner table. But I did talk about my week on the farm, about the Salatins and their animals. I explained the whole synergistic ballet of chickens and cows and pigs and grass without getting into specifics about the manure and grubs and composted guts that made the whole dance work. Thankfully, all of that, the killing cones too, had retreated to the mental background for me, chased by the smoky, sweet aromas of the meal, which I found myself able to thoroughly enjoy. The unexpectedly fine wine helped, too, as did the fact that the dinner table conversation drifted off as it will do, from my Paris Hilton adventures as a farmhand to Willie's songwriting. He is, mark my word, the next Bob Dylan. Matthew's summer football camp, Mark and Liz's books in progress, school, politics, war, and on, the topics spiraling away from the table like desultory rings of smoke. Being a Friday late in June, this was one of the longest evenings of the year, so no one felt in a rush to finish. Besides, I'd just put the souffle in to bake when we sat down, so dessert was still a ways off. In his chapter, Briat Savarin draws a sharp distinction between the pleasures of eating, the actual and direct sensation of a need being satisfied, a sensation we share with the animals, and the uniquely human pleasures of the table. These consist of considered sensations born of the various circumstances of fact, things, and persons accompanying the meal, and comprise for him one of the brightest fruits of civilization. Every meal we share at a table recapitulates this evolution from nature to culture, as we pass from satisfying our animal appetites in semi-silence to the lofting of conversational balloons. The pleasures of the table begin with eating, and specifically with eating meat, in Briat Savarin's view, since it was the need to cook and apportion meat that first brought us together to eat. But they can end up anywhere human talk cares to go. In the same way that the raw becomes cooked, eating becomes dining. All such transformations were very much on my mind that evening, coming at the end of a week of farm work that had put me in much closer touch with the biology of eating than the art. The line from composting chicken guts to gastronomy is almost unimaginably long, but there is a line. While we talked and waited for the souffle to complete its magic rise, the smell of baking chocolate seeped out of the kitchen and filled the house. When at last I told Willie the time had come to open the oven, cross your fingers, I saw his smile blossom first, then the great crown of souffle puffing out from the cinched white waist of its dish. Triumph. Here was the most improbable transformation of all. There's something wondrous about any souffle, how a half dozen eggs flavored by nothing more than sugar and chocolate can turn into something so ethereally other. Souffle, to blow, comes from the Latin word for breath, of course, in recognition of the air that a souffle mostly is. But souffle has a spiritual sense too, as in the breath of life. In English, the word spirit comes from breath, which seems fitting, for isn't the souffle as close as cookery ever comes to elevating matter into spirit? This particular souffle was good, not great. Its texture was slightly grainier than it should be, which makes me think I may have beaten the eggs a little too long. But it tasted wonderful, everyone agreed, and as I rolled the rich yet weightless confection on my tongue, I closed my eyes and suddenly there they were. Joel's hens, marching down the gangplank from out of their eggmobile, fanning out across the early morning pasture, there in the grass where this sublime bite began. Part 3. Personal. The Forest. Chapter 15. The Forager. Serious play. There was one more meal I wanted to make, and that was the meal at the end of the shortest food chain of all. What I had in mind was a dinner prepared entirely from ingredients I had hunted, gathered, and grown myself. Now, there are some people, though not all that many of them anymore, for whom such a radically self-made meal exists firmly in the realm of possibility. I am not one of them. The growing part was the only part I knew I could handle. I've been a gardener most of my life and have made countless meals from my garden. These included no animal protein, however, and I had decided that this meal should feature representatives of all three edible kingdoms, animal, vegetable, and fungi. I was about as ill-prepared to hunt the former and gather the latter as an eater could possibly be. I had never hunted in my life. Indeed, I had never fired a gun loaded with anything more lethal than caps. Being a somewhat accident-prone individual, childhood mishaps included getting bitten in the cheek by a seagull and breaking my nose falling out of bed, I have always thought it wise to maintain a healthy distance between me and firearms. Besides, you have to have had a certain kind of dad in order to join the culture of hunting in America, and mine, one of the great indoorsmen, was emphatically not that dad. My father looked upon hunting as a human activity that had stopped making sense with the invention of the steakhouse. As a recreational pursuit that involved the certainty of going outside and the possibility of the sight of blood, hunting, in his opinion, was something best left to the Gentiles. So in hunting my own dinner, I would be starting very much from scratch. Thanks to my mother's more extensive engagement with the natural world, I did have some childhood experience as a gatherer. During the summer, she would take us to the beach at low tide to dig for steamers, excavating by hand the air holes the clams had made in the sand flats until they squirted us in self-defense. In the waning days of summer, we would pick beach plums that she would transform into a deliciously tart jelly, the brilliant color of rubies. All winter long, her beach plum jelly summoned memories of summer vacation. August on toast. My sisters and I also filled bowls with wild blackberries and huckleberries for dessert. Once, as a teenager, I gathered enough wild grapes to attempt to make wine. My understanding of fermentation was shaky, however, and after a week or so, the sealed container I had put the crushed fruit in exploded, splattering the ceiling and all four walls of the living room where I had left it with grape skin confetti. Another time, I tried to make root beer from the roots of a sassafras sapling. The resulting concoction smelled right, but that was about it. These elementary foraging expeditions were always accompanied by scary, Surgeon General-like warnings from my mother about the deadly poisons lurking in berries and mushrooms growing in the wild. She made it sound like it wouldn't take much for a kid to get himself killed snacking in the woods. So I never picked any but the most iconic fruits, and while I enjoyed eating store-bought mushrooms, I never so much as touched one in the woods. My mother had inculcated a fear of fungi in me that put picking a wild mushroom in the same class of certain-death behaviors as touching downed power lines or climbing into the cars of strangers proffering candy. So my fungophobia was another thing I'd have to overcome if I hoped to ever serve a personally hunted and gathered meal, because wild mushrooms had to be on the menu. Mushroom hunting seems to me the very soul of foraging, throwing both the risks and rewards of eating from the wild into the sharpest possible relief. If I hoped to host representatives of all three kingdoms on my plate, learning to distinguish the delicious from the deadly among the fungi was a necessity. Actually, I hoped to wangle a fourth kingdom in there, a mineral, if I could manage to locate a salt flat within driving distance of my house. Why go to all this trouble? It's not as though the forager food chain represents a viable way for us to eat at this point in history. It doesn't. For one thing, there is not enough game left to feed us all, and probably not enough wild plants and mushrooms either. The prevailing theory as to why, as a species, we left off hunting and gathering is that we had ruined that perfectly good lifestyle by overdoing it, killing off the megafauna on which we depended. Otherwise, it's hard to explain why humans would ever have traded such a healthy and comparatively pleasant way of life for the backbreaking, monotonous work of agriculture. Agriculture brought humans a great many blessings, but it also brought infectious disease from living in close quarters with one another and our animals, and malnutrition from eating too much of the same thing when crops were good and not enough of anything when they weren't. Anthropologists estimate that typical hunter-gatherers worked at feeding themselves no more than 17 hours a week and were far more robust and long-lived than agriculturists, who have only in the last century or two regained the physical stature and longevity of their Paleolithic ancestors. So even if we wanted to go back to hunting and gathering wild species, it's not an option. There are far too many of us and not nearly enough of them. Fishing is the last economically important hunter-gatherer food chain, though even this foraging economy is rapidly giving way to aquaculture, for the same reasons hunting wild game succumbed to raising livestock. It is depressing, though not at all difficult to imagine, our grandchildren living in a world in which fishing for a living is history. For most of us today, hunting and gathering and growing our own food is by and large a form of play. That's not to say there aren't still subcultures of people, especially in rural places, who hunt some portion of the protein in their diet, feed themselves out of their gardens, and even earn an income foraging for wild delicacies such as morels or ramps or abalone. But the exorbitant price these wild tastes bring in the marketplace is only proof that very few of us can be serious foragers anymore. So though a hunter-gatherer food chain still exists here and there to one degree or another, it seems to me its chief value for us at this point is not so much economic or practical as it is didactic. Like other important forms of play, it promises to teach us something about who we are beneath the crust of our civilized, practical, grown-up lives. Foraging for wild plants and animals is, after all, the way the human species has fed itself for 99% of its time on Earth. This is precisely the food chain natural selection designed us for. 10,000 years as agriculturists has selected for a small handful of new traits suited to our new existence. A tolerance for lactose in adults is one example. But for the most part, we still, somewhat awkwardly, occupy the bodies of foragers and look out at the world through the hunter's eye. "We don't have to go back to the Pleistocene," wrote Paul Shepard, an environmental philosopher who exalted wildness and deplored modernity, "because our bodies never left." Somehow, I doubted I would feel quite that at home stalking game in the woods, but it was reassuring to think that in doing so I would be contesting only my upbringing, not my genes. My wager in undertaking this experiment is that hunting and gathering and growing a meal would perforce teach me things about the ecology and ethics of eating that I could not get in a supermarket or fast food chain or even on a farm. Some very basic things about the ties between us and the species and natural systems we depend upon. About how we decide what in nature is good to eat and what is not, and about how the human body fits into the food chain, not only as an eater, but as a hunter and, yes, a killer of other creatures. For one of the things I was hoping to accomplish by rejoining, however briefly, this shortest and oldest of food chains was to take some more direct, conscious responsibility for the killing of the animals I eat. Otherwise, I felt, I really shouldn't be eating them. While I'd already slaughtered a handful of chickens in Virginia, the experience had disconcerted me and left the hardest questions untouched. Killing doomed domesticated animals on an assembly line, where you have to keep pace with the expectations of others, is an excellent way to remain only semi-conscious about what it is you're really doing. By contrast, the hunter, at least as I imagined him, is alone in the woods with his conscience. And this, I suppose, points to what I was really after in taking up hunting and gathering. To see what it'd be like to prepare and eat a meal in full consciousness of what was involved. I realized that this had been the ultimate destination of the journey I'd been on since traveling to an Iowa cornfield. To look as far into the food chains that support us as I could look, and recover the fundamental biological realities that the complexities of modern industrialized eating keep from our view. There is value in any experience that reminds us of our dependency on the soil, plant, animal, man food chain, and of the fundamental organization of the biota, Aldo Leopold wrote in a San County Almanac. He was talking specifically about hunting, but the same might be said of gardening or hunting for mushrooms. Civilization has so cluttered this elemental man-earth relationship with gadgets and middlemen that awareness of it is growing dim. We fancy that industry supports us, forgetting what supports industry. Leopold's injunction was back there somewhere behind my desire to do some hunting and gathering, as no doubt was a line of Henry David Thoreau's that had irritated me when I first came across it years ago. "We cannot but pity the boy who has never fired a gun," he wrote in Walden. "He is no more humane, while his education has been sadly neglected." That pitiable, uneducated boy was me. But this boy was determined now to take up Thoreau's and Leopold's challenges. To personally hunt down and drive into a corner that whole charged web of relations with other species we so blandly call eating. Reduce it to its lowest denominator, look at it squarely, and see whatever there was to see. My forager, Virgil. The desire was one thing, fulfilling it quite another. A whole host of hard questions now strode into view. How was I going to learn to fire a gun, let alone hunt? Did I need a license? What if I actually managed to kill something? Then what? How do you dress an animal you've killed? And what kind of euphemism is that anyway? Was it realistic to think I could learn to identify mushrooms with enough confidence to actually eat them? What I badly needed, I realized, was my own personal foraging Virgil, a fellow not only skilled in the arts of hunting and gathering, and butchering, but also well-versed in the flora, fauna, and fungi of Northern California, about which I knew approximately nothing. You see, there was this whole other complication I've neglected to mention. On the eve of this experiment, I had just moved to Northern California, a place that is an ecological world away from the New England woods and fields that I knew my way around. A little. I was going to have to learn to hunt and gather and garden on what amounted to a different planet, for it was inhabited by dozens of exotic species about which I possessed not the first useful fact. What did people hunt here anyway, and when did they hunt it? Which plant hardiness zone is Berkeley in? What time of year do the mushrooms mushroom around here, and where? As serendipity would have it, a foraging Virgil appeared in my life at exactly the right moment, though it took me a while to recognize him. Angelo Garo is a stout, burly Italian with a 5-day beard, sleepy brown eyes, and a passion verging on obsession about the getting and preparing of food. Shortly after we moved to California, I started running into Angelo at dinners to which we'd been invited, though I noticed that only rarely did he play the typical, more or less passive role of guest. No, Angelo was always intimately involved in the story of the meal. He'd gotten the halibut from a friend at the dock in Bolinas that morning, picked the fennel along the highway on the drive over, made the wine on the table, and brined the olives and personally cured the prosciutto being served. Inevitably, he wound up in the kitchen cooking the dinner or passing platters of his famous fennel cakes to whet our appetites while he explained the proper way to make farro pasta or boar salami or balsamic vinegar, this last assuming you add 10 or 12 years and the right kind of barrels. The guy was a one-man traveling food network, a poster boy for the slow food movement. Eventually, I pieced together Angelo's story. He is a 58-year-old Sicilian from the town of Provencia, who left home at 18, following a girl to Canada. 20 years later, he followed a different girl to San Francisco, where he has lived ever since. He makes his living designing and forging architectural wrought iron. He lives in a forge that has been a blacksmith shop since the time of the gold rush. But Angelo will tell you his consuming passion is food and, specifically, recapturing the flavors and the foodways of his childhood, which he sometimes gives the impression was prematurely interrupted. A particularly successful dish, he will say, is one that tastes like my mother. When I moved away, I would call for recipes and for memory of smell and taste, and now I'm trying to replicate what I left behind. Several months after meeting Angelo, he appeared again, this time, strangely enough, on my car radio. He was being interviewed on public radio for a segment on foraging produced by the Kitchen Sisters. Their microphones followed Angelo on a porcini hunt and then into a duck blind at dawn. While he waited for the sun and the ducks to rise, Angelo spoke in an accented whisper about his past and his passions. In Sicily, I could tell by the smell what time of the year it was, he said. Orange season, oranges, persimmons, olives, and olive oil. Angelo spends many of his days in California recreating the calendar of life in Sicily, a calendar that is strictly organized around seasonal foods. You know, food in Sicily doesn't come from the Safeway, he will say. It comes from the garden. It comes from nature. So there are eels to catch for the traditional 7-fish dinner on Christmas Eve. You almost can't have Christmas without eel. Chanterelles to hunt in January. Wild fennel to gather in April. Olives to pick and cure in August. Grapes to harvest and crush in September. Game to hunt and cure in October. And porcini to hunt after the first rains in November. Each of these rites is performed in the company of friends, and is accompanied by a good meal, homemade wine, and conversation. I have the passions of foraging, passion of hunting, opera, my work, he told the Kitchen Sisters. I have the passion of cooking, picking, curing salamis, sausage, making wine in the fall. This is my life. I do this with my friends. It's to my heart. Even before the radio segment ended, I knew I had found my Virgil. The next time I bumped into Angelo, I asked him if I could tag along on his next foraging expedition. Sure, okay. We go hunt chanterelle in Sonoma. I call you when it's time. Emboldened, I asked about going hunting too. Okay. We could hunt one day, maybe some duck, maybe the pig, but first you need license and learn to shoot. The pig? Clearly there was even more to learn than I had thought. Hunter Ed. It took me a couple of months to sort out the procedures for securing a hunter's license, which involved enrolling in a hunter education course and taking a test. It seems they'll sell a high-powered rifle to just about anybody in California, but it's against the law to aim the thing at an animal without first enduring a 14-hour class and a 100-question multiple-choice exam that demands some study. The next scheduled session was on a Saturday, 2 months off. Yet now that I knew I would be going hunting eventually, for game as well as for mushrooms, something peculiar happened. I became an incipient forager, a forager in waiting. The mere expectation of hunting and gathering abruptly changed what it meant and what it felt like to take a walk in the woods. All at once I started looking at and thinking about everything in the landscape in terms of its potential as a source of food. Nature, as the Woody Allen character says in Love and Death, is like an enormous restaurant. It was almost as if I had donned a new pair of glasses that divided the natural world into the possibly good to eat and the probably not. Though in most cases, of course, I had no idea which was which. Being so new to this, and to this place, my forager vision was far from perfect. Still, I began to notice things. I noticed the soft yellow globes of chamomile edging the path I hiked most afternoons, and spotted clumps of miner's lettuce off in the shade. Claytonia, a succulent coin-shaped green I had once grown in my Connecticut garden, and wild mustard out in the sun. Angelo called it rapini and said the young leaves were delicious sautéed in olive oil and garlic. There were blackberries in flower and the occasional edible bird, a few quail, a pair of doves. Okay, this might not have been the most exalted way of experiencing nature, but it did sharpen my eye and engage my attention in a way it hadn't been engaged in years. I began consulting field guides to help me identify the many unfamiliar species I'd been content to treat as leafy, fungal, and feathery background noise. Hiking in the Berkeley Hills one afternoon in January, I noticed a narrow, shady path dropping off the main trail into the woods, and I followed it down into a grove of big oaks and bay laurel trees. I'd read that chanterelles came up this time of year around old live oak trees, so I kept an eye out. The only place I'd seen a chanterelle before was over pasta or in the market, but I knew I was looking for a yellowish-orange and thickly built trumpet. I scanned the leaf litter around a couple of oaks but saw nothing. Just when I'd given up and turned to head back, however, I noticed a bright, yolky glimmer of something pushing up the carpet of leaves not 2 feet from where I'd just stepped. I brushed away the leaves, and there it was, this big, fleshy, vase-shaped mushroom that I was dead certain had to be a chanterelle. Or was it? How certain was that? I took the mushroom home, brushed off the soil, and put it on a plate. Then pulled out my field guides to see if I could confirm the identification. Everything matched up. The color, the faint apricot smell, the asymmetrical trumpet shape on top, the underside etched in a shallow pattern of false gills. I felt fairly confident. But confident enough to eat it? Not quite. The field guide mentioned something called a false chanterelle that had slightly thinner gills. Uh-oh. Thinner. Thicker. These were relative terms. How could I tell if the gills I was looking at were thin or thick ones? Compared to what? My mother's mycophobic warnings rang in my ears. I couldn't trust my eyes. I couldn't quite trust the field guide. So whom could I trust? Angelo. But that meant driving my lone mushroom across the bridge to San Francisco, which seemed excessive. My desire to sauté and eat my first found chanterelle squabbled with my doubts about it, slender as they were. But by now I had passed the point of being able to enjoy this putative chanterelle without anxiety, so I threw it out. I didn't realize it at the time, but I had impaled myself that afternoon on the horns of the omnivore's dilemma. Chapter 16. The Omnivore's Dilemma. Good to eat, good to think. My encounter with the chanterelle, or was it a false chanterelle, put me in touch with one of the most elemental facts about human eating. It can be dangerous, and even when it isn't dangerous, it is fraught. The blessing of the omnivore is that he can eat a great many different things in nature. The curse of the omnivore is that when it comes to figuring out which of those things are safe to eat, he's pretty much on his own. As noted at the beginning of this book, the omnivore's dilemma, or paradox, was first described in the 1976 paper, The Selection of Foods by Rats, Humans, and Other Animals, by University of Pennsylvania psychologist Paul Rosen. Rosen studied food selection behavior in rats, which are omnivores, in the hopes of understanding something about food selection in people. Like us, rats daily confront the bounty of nature and its manifold perils. Perils designed to protect plants, animals, and microbes from being eaten. To defend themselves from predation, plants and fungi produce a great many poisons, everything from cyanide and oxalic acid to a wide variety of toxic alkaloids and glucosides. Similarly, bacteria colonizing dead plants and animals produce toxins to keep other potential eaters at bay. Also similarly, we humans manufacture toxins to keep rats from eating our food. Among the more specialized eaters, natural selection takes care of the whole problem of food selection, hardwiring the monarch butterfly, say, to regard the milkweed as food and everything else in nature as not food. No thought or emotion need go into deciding whether to eat any given thing. This approach works for the monarch because its digestion can wring everything it needs for its survival from milkweed leaves, including a toxin that makes the butterfly itself unappetizing to birds. But rats and humans require a wider range of nutrients and so must eat a wider range of foods, some of them questionable. Whenever they encounter a potential new food, they find themselves torn between two conflicting emotions unknown to the specialist eater, each with its own biological rationale. Neophobia, a sensible fear of ingesting anything new, and neophilia, a risky but necessary openness to new tastes. Rosen found that the rat minimizes the risk of the new by treating its digestive tract as a kind of laboratory. It nibbles a very little bit of the new food, assuming it is food, and then waits to see what happens. The animal evidently has a good enough grasp of causality, delayed learning, as the social scientists call it, to link a stomach ache in the present to something it ingested a half hour before, and a good enough memory to store that finding as a lifelong aversion to that particular substance. This is what makes poisoning rats so difficult. I might have used the same strategy to test my chanterelle, eating a tiny bit of it and waiting to see what happened. Rosen's early work on food selection behavior postulated that the omnivoral problem would explain a great deal, not only about how and what we eat, but who we are as a species, and subsequent research by him and others, in anthropology as well as psychology, has done much to confirm his hunch. The concept of the omnivore's dilemma helps unlock not only simple food selection behaviors in animals, but much more complex biocultural adaptations in primates, humans included, as well as a wide range of otherwise baffling cultural practices in humans, the species for whom, as Claude Lévi-Strauss famously said, food must be not only good to eat, but also good to think. The omnivore's dilemma is replayed every time we decide whether or not to ingest a wild mushroom, but it also figures in our less primordial encounters with the putatively edible. When we're deliberating the nutritional claims on the boxes in the cereal aisle, when we're settling on a weight loss regimen, low fat or low carb, or deciding whether to sample McDonald's newly reformulated chicken nugget, or weighing the costs and benefits of buying the organic strawberries over the conventional ones, or choosing to observe or flout kosher or halal rules, or determining whether or not it is ethically defensible to eat meat. That is, whether meat or any other of these things is not only good to eat, but good to think as well. End of Disc 9. Audio Evolution presents The Botany of Desire, A Plant's Eye View of the World by Michael Pollan. Read by Scott Brick. From my parents, who never doubted, or if they did, never let it show, and my grandfather, with gratitude. Introduction: The Human Bumblebee. The seeds of this book were first planted in my garden, while I was planting seeds, as a matter of fact. Sowing seed is pleasant, desultory, not terribly challenging work. There's plenty of space left over for thinking about other things while you're doing it. On this particular May afternoon, I happened to be sowing rows in the neighborhood of a flowering apple tree that was fairly vibrating with bees. And what I found myself thinking about was this. What existential difference is there between the human being's role in this or any garden and the bumblebees? If this sounds like a laughable comparison, consider what it was I was doing in the garden that afternoon. Disseminating the genes of one species and not another. In this case, a fingerling potato instead of, let's say, a leek. Gardeners like me tend to think such choices are our sovereign prerogative. In the space of this garden, I tell myself, I alone determine which species will thrive and which will disappear. I'm in charge here, in other words, and behind me stand other humans still more in charge. The long chain of gardeners and botanists, plant breeders, and these days, genetic engineers who selected, developed, or bred the particular potato that I decided to plant. Even our grammar makes the terms of this relationship perfectly clear. I choose the plants. I pull the weeds. I harvest the crops. We divide the world into subjects and objects, and here in the garden, as in nature generally, we humans are the subjects. But that afternoon in the garden, I found myself wondering, what if that grammar is all wrong? What if it's really nothing more than a self-serving conceit? A bumblebee would probably also regard himself as a subject in the garden and the bloom he's plundering for its drop of nectar as an object. But we know that this is just a failure of his imagination. The truth of the matter is that the flower has cleverly manipulated the bee into hauling its pollen from blossom to blossom. The ancient relationship between bees and flowers is a classic example of what is known as coevolution. In a coevolutionary bargain like the one struck by the bee and the apple tree, the two parties act on each other to advance their individual interests, but wind up trading favors. Food for the bee, transportation for the apple genes. Consciousness needn't enter into it on either side, and the traditional distinction between subject and object is meaningless. Matters between me and the spud I was planting, I realized, really aren't much different. We too are partners in a coevolutionary relationship, as indeed we have been ever since the birth of agriculture more than 10,000 years ago. Like the apple blossom, whose form and scent have been selected by bees over countless generations, the size and taste of the potato have been selected over countless generations by us, by Incas and Irishmen, even by people like me ordering French fries at McDonald's. Bees and humans alike have their criteria for selection. Symmetry and sweetness in the case of the bee, heft and nutritional value in the case of the potato-eating human. The fact that one of us has evolved to become intermittently aware of its desires makes no difference whatsoever to the flower or the potato taking part in this arrangement. All those plants care about is what every being cares about on the most basic genetic level, making more copies of itself. Through trial and error, these plant species have found that the best way to do that is to induce animals, bees or people, it hardly matters, to spread their genes. How? By playing on the animal's desires, conscious and otherwise. The flowers and spuds that manage to do this most effectively are the ones that get to be fruitful and multiply. So the question arose in my mind that day. Did I choose to plant these potatoes, or did the potato make me do it? In fact, both statements are true. I can remember the exact moment that spud seduced me, showing off its knobby charms in the pages of a seed catalog. I think it was the tasty-sounding, buttery yellow flesh that did it. This was a trivial,